So today I'm going to talk to you about self-defending software, about software that fixes its own bugs without any human intervention nor attention. So this may sound impossible, but bear with me. So the problem is that your code is full of bugs and vulnerabilities. The good news is that attack detectors exist. You can detect code injection, you can detect memory errors, you can detect lots of other types of problems. The question then, of course, is what kind of remediation do you perform? A traditional approach has been to crash the application to prevent it from doing any additional harm. So this has a lot of problems. You lose data, there's a delay while you try to restart. The attack's just going to recur anyway. And essentially what you've done is you've turned every attack into a denial of service attack. Sometimes that's an okay thing to do, but there's a separate thread of work, and our work falls into that, where you try to patch the application so that it behaves properly in the future. We built a system called ClearView, and its goal is security for legacy software. Now, any system that that aims to do this has to satisfy three requirements. The first is protecting against unknown vulnerabilities. The second is preserving functionality rather than crashing. And the third is handling commercial and legacy software. Let me cover each of these three requirements in a little bit more detail. So an unknown vulnerability is sometimes called a zero-day exploit. If you want to handle these, you can't depend on pre-generated signatures. You can't depend on hard-coded fixes. You can't wait for human reaction. Symantec reports that it takes 28 days on average for humans to produce a fix for a security exploit. And one nice thing is, since our system isn't hard-coded, it actually works for arbitrary bugs as well as attacks, though the evaluation I'm going to show you today is for attacks. The second aim is to preserve functionality. We want the operation to continue to provide service to the users, that is, to provide continuous functionality despite the fact that an attack is underway, that is, not to crash. So this is important in domains that require high availability, essentially any mission-critical application. You can imagine e-commerce servers, process control, communications. And our technique is to create a patch, that is to repair the application, to make the application do something different than the terrible, horrible thing that it's in the middle of doing while it's getting exploited. Now, patching isn't always the right thing to do. Sometimes a denial of service, a crash, is just the right approach, but not always. And in the past, it hasn't really been an option to keep your application running and to despite the attack. So what we're doing is we're adding a new tool to your toolbox, and now you can decide whether this is the right thing for your particular situation. The third requirement is to handle commercial off-the-shelf software. You can't modify the source or executables on disk. You can't expect any cooperation from developers. You can't assume that they've built in survivability features like micro reboots. You can't assume you have source information, not even debug symbols. And really, if you want to be practical, you got to work on x86 Windows binaries. So how does our system do this? What's the secret sauce? The idea is learning. Our system learns from success, and it learns from failure. So from normal executions, it learns what the application does during a normal run. That is, when the system is exercising the behavior it was designed to. And then, from attacks, it learns how the application can be exploited. In fact, every attack is great for our system because the more it gets attacked, the more it learns. And then the repairs it creates get better and better over time as it learns more and more. So that eventually the attack is rendered entirely harmless because the patch has given it immunity, much like an immune system might. So until there's a good patch in place, our system uses a set of attack detectors. And those detect all attacks of given types, and they prevent negative consequences by crashing the system. What that means is, when your system's getting attacked, the first few times it gets attacked, it's going to crash. But after a few attacks and crashes, then it's going to be resilient, and it's going to continue operating despite those attacks. Our system has three main components: attack detection, learning, and repair. So for detection, we use a pluggable detector. You can choose whichever one is your favorite. One thing you'll see from this diagram is that it doesn't depend on the learning component at all. It's independent of that. Essentially, this attack detector is just a classifier. It tells you, for each execution, was that execution a normal execution, or was that execution an attack or a bug? Then the learning takes these classified executions as input, and it learns from the normal executions a set of constraints These look like the things you might write in a cert statement or formal specification. Then that describes how the system behaves during successful runs. And then these constraints are checked during the erroneous runs, the runs that where there was a bug or an attack. The output then of this step is a predictive constraint. A predictive constraint is a constraint that was true on every good run and that was violated on every bad run during every attack. In other words, your detector has determined when things are so hopelessly wrong that it has to crash the system. But this is telling you something that happened much earlier. It's a predictor for the attack. It's telling you something that's closer to the root cause, maybe something that isn't so far gone that you could repair it. And that's what our system does. The repair component creates a set of patches. And the purpose of these patches is to notice that, for instance, suppose there was a data structure invariant, and due to a bug or attack, the data structure invariant gets violated. Well, if you can reestablish that invariant, then your program has a hope of continuing. So the patches reestablish those constraints, then the system evaluates those patches and distributes them. So the final output is then a patch that restores normal behavior. Now, our focus here is really on the learning and repair. The detectors are really off the shelf. Here's a deployment of our ClearView system. There's a central server, and you can imagine that that's replicated or distributed. And it communicates securely with a set of machines, a community that it's protecting. our current threat model does not include malicious nodes, pre-infected nodes. But you could handle those using something, for instance, like Vigilante's approach. Now, each of these community machines performs machine learning to learn normal behavior. So it observes normal behavior and then reports what that is. For instance, we might have one machine that reports that copy len is less than buff size, and another one that reports that copy len is less than or equal to buff size, and a final machine says, well, on every execution, every normal execution that I observed, copy len was always equal to buff size. They report these properties back to the central server, and it generalizes them all. In this case, the proper generalization is that copy len is always less than or equal to buff size. Now remember, we have an attack detector in place, and that's also suppressing the attack. You should choose one that has a number of false positives that's acceptable to you. Ours have zero false positives, which is acceptable to us. We use code injection. We use detectors for code injection and for memory corruption. But lots of other possibilities exist. You can plug your own favorite into our system. So when an attack occurs, the detector notices it. It then terminates the application so that no further harm can happen, but it also sends information about the attack back to the central server. What sort of information? Well, it might say, during this attack, the constraint copy len is less than or equal to buff size was violated. Now, the server collects information from a number of attacks and tries to correlate these violations to the attacks. So it's hoping to find a property that's always true on good executions and always false for a particular attack. We call that a predictive constraint. For instance, maybe we discover that this constraint, copy len is less than or equal to buff size, is predictive. Now the repair component is going to propose a set of patches for each behavior that predicts the attack, for each of these predictive constraints. For instance, suppose that we have this copy len is less than or equal to buff size. You might fix that by setting copy len to buff size. Or you might fix it by setting copy len to zero, or by setting buff size to copy len. Or you might just bail out of this procedure because things seem all messed up and maybe the caller will be able to handle it. The point is that there are a lot of different repairs you can imagine. We need to figure out which of those is the right one to use. So our system distributes those patches all throughout the community, different patches to different machines. And now you just wait. I told you we loved attacks. If we get attacked, we're going to learn a lot more. In particular, maybe when the patch is applied and executed, the attack still occurs. In that case, we say that's an unsuccessful attack. On the other hand, if the patch is applied and executed, and then the attack does not occur, we call that a success. The server can rank all these patches and then send the most successful ones out to the entire community. And what this means is that every machine that's running this application is going to be protected, even if it's never been attacked itself, just because other members of the community have been attacked. So that's really the whole idea. What I want to do now is to dive down and give you a few more details about specific parts of our system, about how it learns normal behavior, about how it learns attack behavior, about how it does repair, what the repairs look like, and how those things get evaluated. And I also want to talk for a moment about our evaluation, which was an adversarial red team exercise. And finally, I'll conclude. So how does the system learn normal behavior? This is exactly the same slide you saw before, just to get you back in context. We have all of the individual community machines, and they're sending back these things that look like these properties back to the central server. But how on earth do these machines compute a formal specification for the program just by watching it operate? So we use a machine learning technique called the dynamic invariant detection that's from my previous work, and an implementation called DICON. DICON initially assumes that everything's true. Copy len is less than buff size, copy len equals buff size, copy len is greater than buff size. But then it observes the values that those variables actually hold. So, and every time it does that, it's able to eliminate some of those constraints. We know that they're not true anymore. And this continues for the entire execution of the program. This is a simple idea, but it takes some algorithmic tricks, some program analysis, some statistical tricks to make it actually work. And we also enhanced it for this project, but I don't have time to tell you about that. I do want to take a moment to remark on the quality of the inference results. Any machine learning technique is not sound. That's because if you present it with unrepresentative data, then it can overfit. Any machine learning technique is not complete because it has a so-called bias, which is a set of properties that it can possibly report. Now, while our system is neither sound nor complete, it has another pleasant property, namely that it's useful and effective. In particular, it's sound in practice and is complete enough to provide the information that's needed by the rest of the system. Furthermore, ClearView has been designed to tolerate any unsoundness in the learning component. In particular, recall that learning doesn't affect attack detection. It has zero false positives, no matter how good or bad your learning is. And for the repair stage, any unsoundness is going to be mitigated by this correlation step that finds the correlated properties, that finds these predictive constraints. And furthermore, the more your program runs, the better your learning results get. So now, that's how we learn normal behavior. Now I want to talk about learning attack behavior. First, I'll say just a word about the attack detectors that can detect attacks or could detect bugs in general. The goal here is to detect problems close to their source. If things start to go wrong in your program and then it continues operating for a long time, probably the program state has become so corrupted that it's going to be hopeless to repair. But if you can find it when it's just started to go wrong, then it may be that a tiny nudge will keep it from going off the tracks. So we use two detectors here. One is for code injection. It's an implementation of program shepherding as implemented by Determiner's memory firewall. And that triggers that the PC ever winds up at an instruction that wasn't in the original executable. The second detector we use is for a memory corruption. We call it heap guard, and it essentially detects wild writes. So important things about these detectors are that they have relatively low overhead and that they suffer zero false positives. But other detectors are possible. And the great thing about this is, if you plug your detectors into our system, suddenly our system will be creating bug patches for whatever problems your detector detects. So how does our system learn from failures? As I mentioned, attacks are good because they provide us information. The first attacks tell you that the vulnerability even exists and where it exists. Further attacks tell you how it gets exploited, how it corrupts the data structure or the program state. And then further attacks tell you what repairs are successful. So here is a picture of our system. All of the client machines are protected, remember, by the monitor that observes an attack and sends information. What kind of information might it send? First off, it might send a stack trace. And it maintains a shadow call stack to do this because many attacks, of course, smash the stack. So now we know what are the most suspicious parts of the code, the parts of the code that seem to be related to this problem. Now the system pushes out instrumentation to all of those locations. So it's going to in procedure main, in process record, et cetera, it's going to be checking all of the constraints. And it's going to be checking those on good runs and on bad runs alike. Now, when a monitor detects a failure, then it can report, these are all the properties that were not true, that were violated during this attack. For instance, maybe it determines that copy len is less than or equal to buffer size was violated during this particular attack. Now, the server correlates those to the attack and tries to find these predictive constraints. So let me summarize what we just learned in this section. First of all, the constraint checking is done only at sites that are related to the attack, that are near the attack. So that means the overhead is relatively low. Secondly, we use these predictive constraints. And a predictive constraint is one that's true on every good execution and false on every attack. So it really is a predictor for the attack. It's not telling you that things are so far gone you have to crash the program, but it's telling you the first signs of something small that's gone wrong. And finally, we create repairs for every predictive constraint. There may be many of them, there may be many repairs. And the purpose of those repairs is to try to reestablish normal behavior. So let's talk about those repairs. So again, this is a slide you've seen before with the patches being distributed to all of the machines. So how do we evaluate whether a patch is any good? We can tell whether the patch has been executed. And if the patch has been executed and the machine doesn't suffer any attack, then we've prevented that attack. That's good. We use all the normal monitoring and detection, but we also install more when we've installed a patch. For instance, ordinarily, we don't think of a crash as something sinister, as an attack. But if a patched application crashes, we call that a bad patch. And you can imagine putting any type of checking in here. For instance, application-specific checking, looking for assertion violations, et cetera, to satisfy whatever consistency constraint is important for your particular program. Let me try to make all this more concrete by giving you an example of an attack. So here, the vulnerability is in a JavaScript system routine that's written in C++. It takes a reference to a C++ object and then calls a virtual method. The problem is that it doesn't check its argument. And so the attack supplies a chunk of memory, and the thing that ought to be the virtual table pointer actually points to arbitrary code. Luckily, there's a predictive constraint at the point of the method call. It says the address of your jump subroutine indirect instruction is always one of a known set. In particular, those are exactly the real implementations of that abstract method in the C++ code. So there are a bunch of repairs you could imagine. You could call one of those known valid methods. They didn't cause a problem in the past. You could skip over the call. You could return early. You can imagine other repairs as well. Let me show you what a repair looks like. Here, this is a repair for our friend copyLen is less than or equal to buff size. And the repair says, if the constraint is violated, then set copyLen to buff size. So the repair always checks the predictive constraint. Now, if the predictive constraint is not violated, there's no problem, and this repair is entirely harmless. It has no effect. If the constraint is violated, then statistically speaking, you are under attack right now. And if you just keep going the way you are, it's going to be a disaster. So we're going to try to improve the situation. Another thing to notice about this is the patch doesn't depend on the detector. In fact, our goal is to prevent the detector from ever triggering. What we want to do is fix the problem while it's small, before the detector has a chance to trigger, and prevent the attack from ever taking hold. Finally, this is not necessarily exactly the patch that a human being would write. But you could imagine using a stopgap until there's human response. We can't afford to wait the 28 days on average that it's going to take for people to fix this. Here's some more examples of constraints and examples of repairs you might imagine using. So the first one at the top is v1 is less than or equal to v2, where the v's are variables. And that's exactly what we just saw. If the constraint is violated, set v1 to v2. And a high-level effect that this low-level patch might have is to truncate your input. The next constraint is v is greater than or equal to c, where c is a constant. So that you can and if that's violated, set the variable to the constant. Now, a high-level effect that this might have is to normalize a variable to a given range, or to take a negative value and make it zero. Another constraint is that a variable is in a given set, and that's exactly the one that was used in our jump subroutine indirect example. And that says, if the variable isn't any of those constants, then you could set it to one of the constants. But there are other more general things you can do, too, you could do for any violated constraint. For instance, you could return from the enclosing procedure if any particular constraint is violated. Another thing you can do is to modify a use of a variable. For instance, suppose you have a call, call star v, an indirect call through a variable. Well, in this case, we can modify that by checking the constraint on v, checking that it's satisfied. So if the constraint is satisfied, in other words, if v is a good value, then go ahead and do the call. Otherwise, don't do the call. Otherwise, skip over it. So this can avoid making a bad call. So how do you evaluate a patch? What we do is in-field evaluation. You saw that we push the patches out, and we make sure that no attack detector is triggered, and there are no other behavior deviations, like a crash or a violation of application invariance or another attack occurring. There are other ways you might imagine validating this. For instance, you could imagine validating the patch before you ever push it out. For instance, by replaying the attack or by running the program's test suite. If these are applicable in your situation, then that's great, and you should go ahead and use them. They don't work in our situation. So now I'd like to talk about our evaluation, which was by way of a hostile red team exercise. So a red team is a bunch of hackers. These are people who are trying to break our system. It's an outside company. They were hired directly by DARPA and paid by DARPA. There were 10 people on the team. The red team created 10 exploits against Firefox, and each exploit is a bunch of HTML. If Firefox ever navigates to that web page, then Firefox executes arbitrary code of the attacker's choosing. And they created actually a number of new exploits, and the exploits had great diversity. For instance, some of them used malicious JavaScript. Others took advantage of errors in the underlying garbage collector. They did some stack smashing, and they also overran heap buffers. And they also took advantage of uninitialized memory and so forth. The protected application was Firefox 1.0, and that was chosen primarily for the convenience of the red team. We were not allowed to tune ClearView to any known vulnerabilities that happened to be in Firefox 1.0. We did focus our learning component on the most security component, critical components of Firefox. That's because we didn't have access to a large community of people who were all running Firefox 1.0, so we could do the learning based on that. The red team had access to everything we did. They had access to our source code, they had access to our binaries, they had access to all of our test suites, they had access to the learned invariants, they had access to all of our documentation, they had access to all of our reports to sponsors, to all of our evaluations, our own evaluations of the weaknesses in our system. They had everything. The results of the exercise is that ClearView was successful. It detected every attack and it prevented every exploit. Now, that's really no benefit to us because we were using off-the-shelf detectors. Much more interesting is that for 7 of those 10 vulnerabilities, ClearView generated a patch that maintained functionality. The red team was unable to observe any deviation from the desired behavior of Firefox while any patch was in place. Furthermore, ClearView did it really fast. It did it after an average of less than 5 minutes and fewer than 6 observations of real attacks. So that means 6 times, for 6 people in the entire community, Firefox is going to crash, and after that it's going to work for everybody. It handled attack variants where there were different attacks that were trying to target the same underlying vulnerability. It also handled simultaneous presentation of attacks that were targeting different vulnerabilities. It didn't confuse the different attacks with one another. It suffered no false positives at all. What that means is it never installed a patch when it wasn't under attack, and a patch was never triggered when it wasn't under attack. Furthermore, the overhead for detection and repair was low. It wasn't noticeable in this interactive application. Depending on the configuration of ClearView, it can be as low as 50%, though if you can imagine plugging in your own favorite detector, which might have different performance characteristics, different completeness characteristics, etc. Now, I said that ClearView repaired 7 of the 10 vulnerabilities. What about the other 3? So the first thing I want to remind you is that the consequence of failure to repair this is that the application continues to crash when attacked. I mean, there's no propagation of the exploit. So in the first case, we just screwed up. We misconfigured ClearView so that it wasn't trying repairs in all procedures on the stack. And the place that the repair was needed was higher on the stack than it was looking. In the second case, it was a problem with learning. As I mentioned, we didn't have access to a community, and it turns out that the that there was a needed invariant that was true but was not statistically significant, so it wasn't reported and it wasn't and no repairs were attempted for it. And in the third problem, the third issue was also a learning problem where there was a constraint that was needed that didn't happen to be built into DICON. Now remember, these are all zero-day attacks against our system, and each of these is trivial to fix with a little bit of tuning, and we verified that after the exercise. So now I'd like to conclude. Because maintaining legacy applications, because survivability is so important, there's been a lot of really excellent work in this area, in detection, in learning, in repair. I don't have time to go into this, but one thing I'd like to point out is that as people continue to improve these techniques, they can be plugged into our system, making it even more effective. I want to thank my 13 co-authors for being a really fun team to work with, very stimulating. And what can we take away from this? So I've described ClearView. This is a framework for patch generation, automatic without any human intervention. It has pluggable modules for detection, for learning, and for repair. And coming back to the three goals, the requirements that I set out at the beginning, it handles all of those. It protects against unknown vulnerabilities, and it does that by learning. It learns from success, learns what the program is supposed to do. It learns from failure, what the vulnerabilities are, where they are, how they affect the program state. And this learning focuses effort where it's needed. ClearView also preserves functionality. It repairs the vulnerability so the program can continue to operate. And there are many situations where that is critical, other situations where you might not want to do that. And finally, it works on commercial software, in particular Windows binaries. And finally, I'd like to note that ClearView has survived an unusually stringent evaluation in terms of a hostile red team exercise. Now I'd be happy to take questions. Okay, so that's a good question. It's a common question. So the question is, what happens if one of our patches actually introduces an entirely new vulnerability? So a couple things to remember is that, first off, you can only do this if you've already found an exploitable vulnerability. So if you can find an exploitable vulnerability and then figure out how to direct our system to create another exploitable vulnerability, you're pretty good. The red team tried to do it, and the red team failed. The other thing is that all our attack detectors continue to be turned on. So, in fact, in the red team exercise, there was a case where our repair enabled another vulnerability, and ClearView found that one and fixed it as well, just a cascading vulnerability. So it was able to handle that. It's always possible that there's an undetected vulnerability, but it's possible that was in your original program as well. And this is designed for situations where you decide that the extremely small likelihood that someone can thread the needle to cause this unlikely sequence of events is less of a problem than unavailability of your system, which you've decided is mission critical. Good question.
One way I might imagine doing that is to try to inject attacks that say set copy lane to buff lane plus one, which happens to be not enough to actually trounce memory and trigger the attack detection, and inject a bunch of these kind of semi-benign instances of the exploit just to cause your database to learn the incorrect fact that buff lane can be either in apparently correct runs, and then after I attacked your database, then try to you know, do the actual attack, and you know, which third view wouldn't detect them? Is your system very vulnerable to that kind of attack? Did the red team try anything in that direction?
Okay, so good question. Essentially, the question here is, we have a set of learned properties, these learned constraints, and we're going to look for deviations from those learned constraints. It doesn't matter what facts are true, what weird facts are true during attacks. This would have to be, if you wanted to poison the database, you'd have to find good executions or executions that weren't observed as being bad and try to poison it that way. So the red team didn't try to do that. They took an existing database and then just worked from that. They had that database. I think it's conceivable that you could do that. I think it's definitely theoretically possible. And I don't know whether it would actually be practicable.
So I think this is great, but I have a question about the use of the invariants from DICON. So if I understood correctly, DICON inserts or generates invariants at function calls, right? Or prior function calls.
I apologize for interrupting. That was true previously. Here, we're actually generating invariants at every instruction of your executable.
So then that leads to my second question. So what is the overhead of that? Because one of the claims in the earlier work was that, you know, by generating invariants only at function call size, you were able to keep the pause positive. So how does that play?
Right, so that's a perceptive question. I mean, it's let me divide into two parts, and you can tell me if I'm being unfair. One question is, how big is the overhead? So now we're actually generating a tremendous number of these constraints at every instruction in the entire program. And that makes our system finely tuned. But what's the overhead, and how much unsoundness or incompleteness are you going to suffer? So in terms of the size of these, they're actually very, very large. On average, you're going to see between 5 and 10 constraints at every instruction in your entire program. And if you look at scalability of our system, really learning is the biggest bottleneck there. We've shown that you can distribute the learning throughout the community, giving each machine a tiny slice to do, and you can drive the overheads arbitrarily low. And of course, using a community also gives you great benefits of diversity. But that's really the part of the system that needs the most work in terms of scalability. In terms of the unsoundness, we're just not seeing that as a problem. And I described on a slide a couple of reasons why that was the case, because of the correlations and because this actually converges much faster than anyone who's not familiar with it believes. Good question.
Sorry, I have only one more question.
I'm wondering how sensitive you are to the invariants that I have to specify for your patches on the data. Because your example is about Firefox, where if I show you a slightly incorrect page, it's all right. But I'm imagining a bank server where your patch decides it's OK to take your transaction and says deposit $10 and set your bank account to zero. That would be legal, and your patch would continue. And at some point later on, you're going to discover that your bank account went wrong. So how sensitive are you for this kind of thing with a continuation of the system actually is introducing some incorrectnesses into the persistent state?
Okay, that's a great question. It's sort of related to the first one. So the red team tried to do all of this, and they were unable to do it. We just haven't seen that ever happen in practice.
But you were looking at Firefox. What was the persistent data that you were looking at?
So they actually were able to use a debugger to see exactly what it was doing. It's true. It's absolutely theoretically possible that that could happen. Now, you would have to decide, this is a policy decision, right? An hour of downtime for a bank is about $6 million. So you have to decide, and they make errors all the time. It's an open secret. They go back and fix them in journaling. So you know, you have to decide whether the very small possibility, just as DICON is neither sound nor complete, but effective and useful, so is our system. And you have to decide whether our system is appropriate for your particular scenario. Thanks very much.